As if we hadn't given you enough challenges, well, with learning all the negotiating tactics, learning how to analyze the different personalities that you'll be dealing with, and watching carefully for body language, now we want to add one more dimension to it, and that is looking for the hidden meanings in conversation. Whenever a president of the United States makes a speech, he invariably reads it, particularly if it involves foreign affairs, because every single word in that speech will be analyzed, will be put under a microscope by the other countries to determine exactly what he meant to say. And very often what's left out of a speech will be just as meaningful to them as what was put in. When you know that someone who's very skilled at analyzing conversation will be analyzing every word, it's very difficult for you not to give away the hidden meanings in conversation. And if you're aware, as you will of course be, of your hidden agenda in the negotiations, and you're coming from a certain perspective, it's not difficult for the other party to learn a lot about your hidden agenda from reading the way you talk. So not only must you be skillful in analyzing their hidden meanings, but you must be careful not to give away your own hidden meanings. One defense that presidents of the United States have in this matter, of course, is that they send their press secretary to make announcements, and they don't give the press secretary all the information that they have. I was recently involved in a negotiation that would have led to the merger of two companies. One of the skeletons that we had in our closet was that one of our major stockholders was in serious financial straits and was very, very anxious to make the merger at any price. We didn't want the other side to know this, of course.
Negotiating.
At one point in the negotiations, the president of the other company said, "I'm concerned about your relationship with Mr. X. I feel that if we ran a credit check on him, we'd find that he has serious financial problems." The manner in which the statement was made puzzled me. He didn't say, "We have run a credit check on him," which he was perfectly capable of having done. He didn't start off his sentence with, "As you're well aware, so-and-so has credit problems." He said, "If we were to run a credit check." This alerted me to the fact that he was in contact with someone within our organization who had passed this information on to him. Later on in the conversation, he said to me, "Roger, you're an outside director of the corporation." That means that while I sat on the board of directors, I didn't work for the corporation. He continued, "I understand that you recently spent an entire day at the corporation interviewing all of the key employees. That's a strange thing for an outside director to do. Why did you do that?" Well, I'd done it because I'd suspected some severe conflicts within the ranks of the organization. It hadn't turned out as badly as I'd feared, but anyway, I didn't know quite how to respond to his question. But then I remembered how he had phrased the previous question and the suspicion that there was someone within our company that was feeding him information. And based on that response, I immediately knew that he had already read my confidential report from that day's activities. And I responded accordingly. The lesson here is to listen very, very carefully to the words that people use. If something strikes you as being very strange, then jot it down word for word and analyze it later. Very often people can say things and mean exactly the opposite of what they say. Let's take a look at a few of those expressions that probably mean exactly the opposite. If someone starts off a conversation with, "In my humble opinion," they probably mean exactly the opposite. They're not humble, they're egotistical. In fact, they're so great, they can profess to be humble. When you ask an opinion of someone and the person responds, "Well, he's a fine church-going person," this probably means that the fact he goes to church on Sunday is his only attribute. And if someone says to you, "We can work out the details later," that probably means that there's quite a bit of negotiating to be done yet. You're not as close to agreement as he wants you to believe. And the classic, of course, is, "Don't worry." If your daughter calls you up at 3 o'clock in the morning and says, "Daddy, don't worry," what should you do? Start worrying. There's another group of expressions that should really alert you because they precede a very important part of the conversation. They're called throwaways, such as you're aware, incidentally, or before I forget, and by the way. As you're aware may precede, "As you're aware, we control 51% of the proxy votes in the company." Well, of course, you were not aware of that. It's a major point, and they just tried to drop it in at the tail end of the sentence. Incidentally, before I forget, and by the way, these throwaway expressions usually precede a monumental announcement. The classic of all was when President Truman was meeting with Churchill and Stalin at Potsdam at the end of World War II. The war in Europe was over and the war in Japan was still going on. Truman had told Churchill that we have the atomic bomb, but he had not told Stalin. And over dinner that night and a few vodkas, he said, "Oh, by the way, Mr. Stalin, we have the atomic bomb." Mr. Stalin responded, "Oh, yes, we're aware of that." Of course, he wasn't. Exactly the opposite was true. But even the most dramatic pronouncements can be preceded by these throwaways, such as "incidentally" and "by the way." So perk up when you hear them. Look out also for legitimizers. Expressions such as "frankly," "honestly," "to tell the truth." They're usually trying to legitimize a statement which is not fully true. When somebody says to you, "Honestly, I don't think we could live with a proposal like that," what does he mean by "honestly"? Has he been dishonest up to now? Or could it be that he's just trying to add a little more convincing power to what he's telling you? And even then, he's not being strictly honest with you. One of the favorite expressions in American literature is one of the last words of Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, when Rip Butler says to Scarlett O'Hara, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." Well, students of language and of hidden meanings in conversation would instantly pounce on that word, "frankly." It's a legitimizer. He's trying to make legitimate what he really doesn't believe. In actual fact, he did give a damn. And if a sequel to Gone with the Wind were ever written, we'd be sure that Rhett Butler would be back together with Scarlett O'Hara. Justifiers are words which lay the foundation for failure. There is an expression such as, "I'll try my best," or "I'll see what I can do," "I'll try to keep it under $300. All of these expressions fall far short of a firm commitment, don't they? And they're preparing you for the fact that they may fail. So unless you're willing to live with that, challenge it at that point. Even worse is when a justifier is changed into the plural. Instead of saying, "I'll give it every effort," all of a sudden it becomes, "We'll give it every effort," hiding behind the group. No salesperson worth his salt will ever accept the excuse, "Well, I'd like to think it over." But if the "I" changes to "we," then really look out. If someone during the entire negotiation has been saying, "Well, I don't think I can afford to pay that much," or "I wouldn't be willing to do that," or "I would have to get you to," and all of a sudden he switches to, "Well, we'll have to think it over," or "We'll give you a decision tomorrow," you're in serious trouble. And you'd better get back in there and do some more selling, because it's just not going to fly. There are many erasers, but the most popular are the words "but" and "however." And what you have to learn about these words is that they erase everything that's gone on before. Someone can tell you for 10 minutes how much they enjoy your product, and they can look like a certainty to buy your product, but if this 10-minute discourse ends with a "but" or "however," erase that 10 minutes and know that you'll have to start again. Because the eraser word, "but" or "however," literally erases everything that's gone on before. When the eraser is preceded by a sentence such as, "I'm just a country boy, but," or "I'm no student of the law, however," or "I never graduated from college, but," or "I've never fully understood it, however," "it's none of my business, but," these are called deceptions. And that's exactly what they are. For example, when somebody tells you, "I'm just a country boy," they mean far from that. In fact, somebody once said that to Lyndon Johnson when he was in the White House, and Lyndon Johnson, who was himself a country boy, exploded and said, "Listen, mister, in this town, when somebody says that to me, I feel like putting my hand on my wallet." If somebody says to you they're no student of the law, they may not be, but you can be assured that they know exactly what they're talking about in that particular instance. A group of sentences which are very important to salespeople are called preparers. When a salesperson says to you, "I don't mean to be personal," you can be sure that he's about to be very personal. "I don't mean to be personal, but when did you file bankruptcy?" When he says, "I don't want to intrude," what's he about to do? Intrude. Another way to prepare people for a potentially difficult question is to exaggerate it. Let's say that people want to ask you what your income was last year because they're filling out a credit application. They may say to you, "This is very embarrassing, but..." Now, in that 3 seconds, all kinds of things are running through your mind about how embarrassing this could be. And when you find out that the only thing they're asking for you is your income, it's much easier to take. Someone might say to you, I need a big, big favor. You're thinking he's probably going to ask for $1,000 or at least $500. And when they ask you for $50 or $100, it seems like such a little thing. So look out for that one. In the negotiating process, you'll frequently encounter trial balloons. These are the type of sentences that start off with, I haven't given it a lot of thought, but... Or, just suppose that we... Or, off the top of my head, I would think that... Or, what would happen if we... The other side has made up their mind that they'd like to try something, but they're not sure if you'll go along with it or not. So they're sending up a little trial balloon. This tells you two things. First of all, it tells you that they would accept what they're suggesting, however little thought they claim to have given it. So, in effect, they've narrowed their negotiating range. It also tells you that they're not sure that you'll accept it, so you can probably do a lot better if you push a little harder. Another important part of hidden meaning in conversation is the realization that people tend to be oriented to one particular sense. By that, I mean that we all interpret everything that we experience through our different senses, like sight, hearing, feel, or taste. Most of us have an orientation towards one of those senses. Taste is the most unusual. The most popular three that you'll encounter are sight, hearing, and feeling. And you can tell which orientation a person has by the kind of language that they use. Let's suppose, for example, that three people go together to a symphony concert. The three people are an oil painter, a piano player, and a poet. Now, if they follow their professions, you would expect that the oil painter would be primarily sight-oriented. What he sees will be much more important than what he feels or hears, whereas the piano player will be oriented to hearing. What he hears will be more important than what he sees or feels. And the poet will be oriented to his feeling. What he feels will be more important than what he sees or hears. So each one of them will come away with a different interpretation of what happened. Although the orientations of the people you'll meet in negotiations may be not that pronounced, they still exist, and they can still be important to your strategy. They'll tell you which orientation they have from the way they talk. For example, a person whose orientation is through sight, like the oil painter, will say things like, yes, but will our people see it that way? Or, that looks good to me. Or, I see what you mean. Whereas the person like the piano player who's oriented to hearing more than sight or feeling will say, that sounds good to me, or I hear you. And the person who's primarily a feeling type person, like the poet, will say things like, I feel good about this, or I can warm to that suggestion. So it follows that if you're dealing with someone who's primarily visual, you'll want to use a presentation binder or go to a chalkboard and draw it out for him so that he can actually see it. This won't be so important with someone who has an audio orientation. In fact, it could even turn off somebody like this. They might even resent you visually explaining what you just said. Their inner language may be saying, you don't have to paint a picture for me. I heard you the first time. Be sure you mirror people's conversations. If people are in the audio mode, they're saying, that sounds good to me. Don't respond with, well, that looks good to me too. Among people who study that kind of thing, that's called a crossed response. As with the study of body language, there are people who can get completely carried away with the study of hidden meanings in conversation. What we've given you here is, of course, a very brief overview. As you become more aware of the subject, as you study more closely what people say, and as you learn to interpret with more skill what people say, you'll become more interested in it, and your knowledge will automatically grow. Throughout this program on negotiating, I've always tried to emphasize the win-win philosophy. That the answer to negotiations is not to dominate the other person, but to achieve a win for them also. Always remember that people will give you what you want, not when you dominate them, not when you overpower them, but they'll give you what you want when you've been able to give them what they want. I've tried to stress my conviction that in any negotiation, the object is not to beat your opponent, but rather to creatively reach an agreement in which each negotiator can feel that he's a winner. I maintain that in every negotiation, no matter what the object of negotiation is, both sides can win. More than that, I maintain that both sides should win. We've talked about some of the standards of good negotiating, those benchmarks by which the value of a negotiation may be judged. These standards shouldn't be any less lenient than those used by the silver craftsmen in old England as they hammered their mark into their wares. These standards can help you determine not only whether you won or lost, but how you played the game. The first standard that you should consider is the question as to whether everyone involved in the negotiation feels like a winner. You've probably not completed a good negotiation if the other party walks away from the table thinking, "Is he a great negotiator? I can't believe it. He talked me out of everything." Rather, a good negotiation has been completed when both parties can walk away from the deal feeling as though they had accomplished something important. The second benchmark is the feeling that each cared about the objectives of the other. If you felt that the other party was listening to you, and if not being gratuitous, then at least taking into consideration your needs, and if the other party had the same feeling about you, then you as a negotiator probably succeeded in creating an atmosphere of communication in which a win-win settlement could be reached. The third benchmark to watch for is the belief that should be held by each side that the other was fair in the way it conducted the negotiations. A football team doesn't mind losing the game nearly so much if they know that the other side was playing by the rules. A political candidate doesn't mind his loss so much if he believes that his opponent has waged a fair and reasonable campaign. It's when there's foul play, a rule is broken, or something sneaky is going on, that negotiations really suffer from the feelings of betrayal that one party will hold of the other. The attitudes of both parties as they leave the negotiation should be, "Well, they were tough, and they fought hard, but they did listen to my point of view. I believe that they were fair in the way that they conducted the negotiations." Benchmark number four. Each negotiator should feel that he would enjoy dealing with the other at some time in the future. Like two chess players leaving a match, if the game was conducted fairly and well, each would want to play the other again. Not to outdo the other or get revenge, but simply because the process of dealing together was enjoyable and challenging. The fifth standard of judgment entails the belief held by each party that the other party is determined to keep the commitments made in the contract. Each side should have a good reason to believe that the other will uphold the conditions of the agreement. If either side feels that, given an opportunity, the other side would back down from his promises, then that negotiation was not a win-win negotiation. My definition, therefore, of a win-win negotiator is a person who can get what he wants out of a negotiation and still bring himself up to the standards established by these five benchmarks. And a losing negotiator is someone who has not filled the requirements of those benchmarks, no matter how many of his own objectives he gained in the negotiation. It's important to understand that every person acts only in his own self-interest and must therefore be motivated from that base. This is called needs negotiating by international negotiators. This philosophy stresses the point that people will only act in order to meet their own needs, not necessarily to meet the needs of someone else. In order to reach a workable agreement, the winning negotiator respects the needs and values of his opponent and works actively to satisfy those needs as well as his own. Spend some time with the ideas that we've discussed. If you'll work to apply them in everyday situations, you'll acquire a surprising amount of control in any situation in which you're dealing with other people. Use these techniques to help you reach the level of success that you desire for yourself. And remember, everything that you need or want is currently owned or controlled by someone else. Now you have the skills that you'll need in order to deal with these people more effectively. It's up to you to use them ethically to reach an agreement that's to the advantage of everyone concerned. A win-win solution. This is Roger Dawson, wishing you good luck in all of your negotiations.
This completes Roger Dawson's The Secret of Power Negotiating. Now you understand that with the win-win philosophy of negotiating, you will achieve whatever you want. Whether you need to negotiate at home, the office, or at the PTA, the techniques you've learned in this program will help you reach settlements more quickly and more productively than ever before. And each time you review this program, you'll find that the techniques become more natural and more a part of your daily activities. Now we'd like you to hear an excerpt from another outstanding Nightingale Conant program. It's Unlimited Power with Tony Robbins. This six-cassette series teaches you how to use the new science of neurolinguistic programming. In the following excerpt, Tony Robbins tells you about the power of state, that is, how you can get the results you want by knowing how to change yours or someone else's state of mind.
Great leaders and great motivators understand the power of state and how to change it in other people. The ability to change other people's states is a quality that can also change the quality of your life. I mean, haven't you ever walked into a restaurant and had the waiter or waitress walk up to you and say, "What do you want?" and be upset with you, and you haven't even done anything? Well, what's your response? Do you usually say, "Oh, this person's doing the best they can with the resources they have. They're in a poor state, so they're treating me poorly." It's highly unlikely. Usually we get upset as well. But in our getting upset, it doesn't change anything. We don't get better service. That person's still upset. What if instead you were to say, "Hey, this person is responding out of a poor state. They're not an unresourceful person. They're just in an unresourceful state. And I can change their state and change their behavior." How can one do this? Well, it's simple. Change the way that they're representing who you are. If they walk up and go, "What do you want?" you can go, "Nothing right now. I mean, I can see they're overworking you. Why don't you take your time and help everyone else, and when you have a chance, come on back and take my order." What's that going to do? The person's going to probably look back and go, "Oh, I'm sorry," and they're going to reevaluate the state there, and they're going to say, "I'm sorry, I'm just stressed out because I didn't get any sleep last night, or I just argued with a cook, or I've been arguing with my boyfriend and I've been thinking about that, or the last people didn't leave me a tip," or whatever, something that's affecting their state. And they'll go, "No, I want to take your order." And you go, "No, please help everyone else first, then come back to me." They go, no, I want to help you." Okay. You can change people's states and have fun doing it.
For more information about any of Nightingale Conant's fine audio and video programs, or to place an order for Unlimited Power, just call toll-free 1-800-323-5552. And come hear us again.
This is the end of Side 12. Side 11 is already queued up for your listening.